What's up, everybody? Thanks for listening to the Fathom and Friends podcast. I'm your host, Adam Tiller. I want to say thanks to everyone listening. As a reminder, please follow us on Instagram at FNFpod. Also follow our cartoon on Instagram at Beefcake and Butterball. Please share this podcast with a friend to help us reach new listeners. For all of the content, go to AdamTillerComedy.com. All right, let's get started with some reads from our sponsors. This episode is brought to you by The Legend of Quentin Jones. One of only three black male comedians to ever perform in Seattle, Quentin Jones left before anyone really noticed. But he won't be forgotten and potentially might be interviewed on this podcast someday. Until then, the legend of Quentin Jones stays strong. Sitting on a stool somewhere, not due to the size of his waistband, but because of the size of his sense of self.
Legend of Quentin Jones.
This episode is also brought to you by the I Killed Your Dog podcast. Comedian and vet technician Valina Taskov and Brittany Hardfielder host the I Killed Your Dog podcast, where the only thing they kill is your perceptions of the veterinary industry. Listen to these two facetiously giggle at macabre stories and candidly discuss the foibles and rewarding work of veterinary medicine. Now, I know I just mispronounced a lot of those words, but either way, check out this podcast and make sure to follow them on Instagram at I Killed Your Dog Podcast. No, Valina and Brittany did not pay me to promote their podcast.
It's been a short ride, but man, it's been a crazy one. The shit we seen and overcame and all of it has made us some hell of a bunch of kids of stories for the ages of how the hell we got here. You can read it in the pages of receipts and tweets and poems that we left along the way. Every day is something new. I see the look on mama's face. I know this world is sick and it's twisted. The kids never listen. My prince in the system invents on a pistol. I never seen the music, but he pulled it out a couple.
That was Travis Thompson with the intro music. My guest today was a professional wrestler for 18 years before getting into comedy. As a comic, he's a recipient of a golden ticket on the Kill Tony podcast hosted by comedian Tony Hinchcliffe and has over 750,000 followers on TikTok with comedy sketches featuring his catchphrase, "What's that?"
What's that?
I'm excited to welcome Todd Royce.
What's going on, man? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, for sure. That light's still going, right?
Yeah, it's
okay,
on.
Okay, we're good. We got all kinds of video, audio, setup stuff together here before we started.
Some issues with the bubbly.
Dude, I am so bad at this shit. Like, I if I didn't have a guy helping me, I would be the worst at it. I don't know what for you with all your TikTok stuff. Like,
well, my TikTok stuff is literally just me sitting on a couch doing this.
I'm jealous.
Yeah, that's all it
incredible,
is.
Incredible, dude.
It's fun. Should I say fun or easy? I think it's easy. I think that's the reason why I did it for so long before it caught on, is because I was just bored at home and I was like, well, let me just do this stuff. Because
I wanted to ask you about wrestling first, but let's just fucking go straight into TikTok. How did that happen? Like, for anybody that isn't familiar with Todd, what's that? Is your kind of catchphrase, your comedy sketch? Like, what happened with that?
So, well, we had this thing in the United States, and it might have been worldwide too. It was the pandemic, the COVID. You remember COVID?
Yeah, I remember that.
We're at home. No comedy clubs were open. I was losing my mind.
Yeah.
And so I heard about TikTok. I made fun of TikTok. I found out recently, I don't know if I'm jumping ahead here, but I found out recently that Shad Foster had come to an open mic and was all excited because he had like 15, 20,000 followers on TikTok. Mm-hmm. And apparently I made fun of him for being on TikTok as a grown adult.
Really?
Yeah. And I don't remember that at all, but he hit me up with that. He's like, I literally quit TikTok a couple of days later because I thought about
That's
what you said.
So funny.
And then he's like, 6 months later, you have 500,000 followers.
That's what, so you were doing stand-up before you created the TikTok?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I was doing stand-up for a couple of years before that.
And that, like, what happened? Because your sketch, you posted it. I've had like Joe Dombrowski on. He's coming back on the podcast, but like he did a viral April Fool's video, and it was literally his phone would not stop vibrating for like 2 days.
Yeah.
What was the reaction to your sketch, and like what how did it come about?
So I was watching, I was scrolling through TikTok. I would do my own video. This is the problem. Are you on TikTok?
Yeah.
Okay. So you know what it's like. It's like at first you kind of look at it and you're like, this is stupid. And then after a while, the next thing you know, you're scrolling through for hours on end.
Yeah. I only get like big titty TikToks or like big butt TikToks.
So you watch my TikToks. That's cool. And so I was scrolling through and there was a common theme going on where black TikTokers would go like, here's the top five things all white people say. And it was really funny. It was like, like let's skedaddle or let's rock and roll, whatever it was, yeah. Right? But like I'd always go to the comments and in the comments it was always white people going, well, it's white people couldn't do that. You couldn't do that if you were white. And so I was like, screw it, I'll do it. So I did this. I just, the way that I just kind of was going about it, I wanted to do, this might sound horrible, but I wanted to do the black voice.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so, you know what I'm saying. Yeah. And so, by the way, I'm never getting booked in Seattle again after I say that. But so I went out and so I did this TikTok and I go, here we go, top five things all black people say. Number one, hey man. And then I just like, I always love pretending someone was off the camera telling me I couldn't say something. I even did that during wrestling promos and stuff like that. I just always love that thing. And so I was just, what's that? Oh, I can't do it. No, that makes sense. And so like, that was it. And TikTok immediately took it down. Like 15 minutes later, it was really? Gone. Yeah. Okay. And then they offer a thing where you can appeal if they take down your video. And so I hit appeal and then maybe an hour later, they reposted it. They said there was nothing wrong with it. And then it went viral like right after that. Like that day, I'm just watching it bounce up to 20,000 viewers, 30,000, 100,000, 300,000.
Damn.
And I was like, and the whole time I'm thinking, I got to get a t-shirt made where I was like, hey, man, you know, but everybody in the comments was like, what's that? That's so funny. And so then I just started doing videos with that.
Okay. So how, like, what did it peak at? Or is it still climbing?
No, that one, because that was like a year and a half ago or something like that. That video, I think, peaked at like maybe 1.5 million,
okay,
something like that. The biggest one that I've had, I haven't had like, when you look at really huge creators, I haven't had like 25 million or whatever, but the biggest one I think I've done is at 8 million right now. And it had like Lance Bass commented on it and stuff like really weird stuff like that.
Yeah. But, It's so wild. Like, have you learned quite a bit from doing that just about like the algorithm and like what kind of gets pushed out or?
I wish I could figure it out because here's and this is the problem that I'm having with TikTok right now is that you get people who report your videos, right? And then they give you the chance to appeal. And if they put your video back up, it still counts against you as you went against their community guidelines, even though they said the video is okay. Mm-hmm. So I have this whole long list of videos. Most of them have been reposted after TikTok looked at it and was like, oh, we get it. But you still have all of these knocks against you. So now my video, like I got kicked out of the creator fund. I don't have, I'm kind of shadow banned. So a lot of my videos aren't getting played out on the For You page.
Yeah.
And, but the problem with that is the only videos that do get out on the FYP, and I can't figure it out, is when I do push the line. And I do, like, I just recently had one go viral where I said, I stitched somebody who was like, it was a black guy who said, white people, what do black people smell like? And I went, shit, what's that? No, you know, like that stupid thing, right? And then now that's up to 2 million views, but that's the only, but it's like.
But it gets reported.
It gets reported. I'm on the possibility of losing my account, but it's the only thing that'll get me views. So I have no idea how to figure it out.
So we just posted one. And before I forget, if you're watching us on YouTube, hit the subscribe, like, share button. Help us out. Comment on this. Say something. Say whatever you want. What's say something that?
Terrible about say, me.
Yeah, anything. Just please don't report us. But. We posted something recently where Jesse Warren was just on and we were talking about Yu-Gi-Oh! Because he was like the Northwest champion.
Yeah.
And there's a huge following of Yu-Gi-Oh! On TikTok and just it like hit a subcategory and then it just popped off. But then it just turns into like all these arguments happening in your comment section. And Paul Curry, he was on too recently. Like, he was saying, once you get a certain number of people in any space, arguments start happening in the comment section.
Right.
Like, do you just see wild shit in yours?
Oh, yeah. Like, and usually I let it go if it's not too, I mean, like, there's been times where I've deleted stuff over the years because it's just, or over the time that I've been on TikTok because it just gets too crazy. But usually it's like by the time I actually go back and read it, because I don't like go and read all of the comments and all the videos, but usually it gets to the point where by the time I see it, there's been one person saying something and then like two other people. So there's a big debate going on, big argument going on. And I kind of understand that everybody wants to like, okay, what's he going to say? What, you know? And so like, I don't want to just delete it at that point. When I did that last one that I told you about, I deleted so many comments because there was so many people that were saying things like, they smell like they smell like EBT cards or whatever. And it's like, dude, shut up. But almost weirder than that to me was because, like, you know, it's the internet. You're going to get some racism, right? Yeah, yeah. that's going to happen.
There's some wild shit on TikTok, too.
Dude, like, dude, for real.
Like, I could not, I mean, the shit that gets reported versus what for some reason gets reposted, it's
wild. It doesn't, yeah. A lot of it doesn't make any sense at all. I remember there was a video that was going around for like 6 months and a lot of black creators and white creators too were begging TikTok to take it down because it was just this white girl walking around in full blackface and every video she posted was just her in blackface. Literally doing nothing but walking around in blackface. And it's just like, people are like, how is this okay?
Dude, this issue though around big tech and creatives, like, it's such a complicated thing. Like, and we have to all play in this space. And it seems like they always err on the side of like hyper caution. I don't know what, I mean, we've been lucky where we haven't dealt with it, but it's like, you're trying to engage in this specific audience and the way you communicate with them is different than how you would communicate with like a random person. But then when you start pushing it out to everyone,
right,
the message gets misconstrued. So it's like, you don't know what white girl in blackface was trying, like who she's trying to talk to necessarily.
That's true. No, that's true. That's
and like, there could be like this running bit and the context just gets lost.
Well, and that's one of the things that I've said a bunch of times, because like, I understand if you're like, okay, if people get offended at a comedy club about jokes, I could care less. Because I'm like, you're at a comedy club, these are jokes, you know that going in. But when people get ticked off on a TikTok video or like even one of my videos, I understand someone reporting it.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, they probably just went through 17 videos of hyper, super racist stuff. And then all of a sudden I pop up and I'm like, black people, hey man.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And like, they don't understand the context immediately. And so they're like, screw it, let's report them. What bugs me is that when, you know, supposedly someone goes to review it and then they're like, oh yeah, no, that's not.
There's no way someone's reviewing it.
It can't be. But then I don't understand. Some videos get reposted and some don't.
Yeah.
It's just a weird, it's
the such problem is we're all trying to figure out the logic
right.
of a purely like, it's a computer program.
Totally illogical.
So like, there's logic built into it, but it doesn't necessarily factor in emotion, like all this other
right,
shit.
Right. And I don't understand some stuff. I got a buddy down in LA who's been doing TikTok about as long as I have.
Yeah.
He's got twice as many followers. He doesn't do like whatever, but he's making like, I think he's saying he's making like $30,000, $40,000 a month just off of his, all of his internet stuff. And he doesn't understand anything that's going on. He's like, one day he'll get no views on anything. Next day he's getting 2 billion views.
It doesn't make any sense. Is, at all. So you've been like touring off of it though, right?
Yeah.
Is that with that guy?
It's Josh Nasser is the guy, the untalented, ugly. He's just,
I've worked with Josh.
Yeah. He's horrible. Right?
He's
a lot.
A lot, yeah.
He's a lot.
But he is a very nice person, and I felt bad because I taped one of his sets.
Oh, yeah. You don't want to even watch one of his sets. Well, you feel terrible.
You guys are close. Yeah. But he, like, I didn't have it in focus, so it was just all blurry and shit for the actual video I had of him. But
did he go off on you about it?
No.
Because Josh is one of those guys that you never, like, I remember one time I texted him at, like, 8:30 in the morning, and he was, I thought he was joking at first. He was legit pissed because I guess he was just in one of those moods. But he's just like, how the fuck? What are you texting me so early in the morning? I'm sleeping, Doc. Dude, calm down.
He's an intense guy.
Yeah, he's very intense.
Yeah, but you guys do the road together. How is, like, a buddy of mine wanted me to ask, like, how well does the following on TikTok lead to like actual audience coming out?
It's not super great at all, because it's so weird, because you can't directly promote to people on TikTok.
Yeah.
You're even if you have 750,000 or a million and a half followers, your videos don't go to all those people. So it's still the algorithm. So like if I post something, or there's been so many times where I've gone to, like, for example, I did Oklahoma City, and I, for months, Oklahoma City, like on every video, Oklahoma City had the date on there and everything like that. We got there, not a bad turnout, but not a great turnout.
Yeah.
Show went well. And then literally within a week, I had at least four or five comments on videos going, "You should come to Oklahoma City." And it's like, it's literally like someone's just sitting there kicking you in the nuts. Cause you're so like,
what's the workaround though? Cause YouTube seems to be the place where it makes the most sense, at least where your content's housed in one place and people can subscribe.
Right.
That's
what I've been focusing more on YouTube. At this point, I'm up to, I think, 31,000 subscribers now. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, like, I'm kind of planning to take time off the road for a few months, starting in after my Dallas shows in July, and then I'm not going to do anything on the road for a couple of months, and I'm just going to focus on one, building up new material and doing mics and local shows and stuff like that. But then two, focus on working up a bigger audience on YouTube and on Instagram, because both of those you could directly, like, I just did a show with Ed Bassmaster.
Yeah.
Right. He's an internet guy. He's not even he didn't even do stand. He did stand up for a little bit before he got into internet, but he's just an internet guy.
Yeah.
That's all he does. And he's sold out a couple of shows in Portland. He sold out Tacoma Comedy Club. He sold out Spokane. All during the week. Like, we were a Wednesday show and the club was completely sold out. Because he isn't depending on TikTok. He's depending on YouTube and Instagram. And that's where, like you said, that's where you get your biggest loyal following.
How do you feel as a comic when you're working with somebody like that, that doesn't, they're not a stand-up and they're doing a show like that? I mean, do you see some pretty rough stuff, or?
I feel humiliated. I feel embarrassed for them and their family. No, I think it's one of those things. It's good for the club. Like, the club, usually on a Wednesday night, they're doing open mic, and you know, they're happy if they get 30 people. Mm-hmm. Here, they're sold out. They made money. He made money. I made money. Mm-hmm. He brings in someone like that, brings in an audience that isn't a normal stand-up comedy club audience. Cause I had people coming through my merch line, and they were a very good merch buyers, and they were coming through the line and they're just like, never been to a comedy club before. This is so fun.
Yeah.
So that it is a way to like bring a new audience. The show itself, it was interesting because he was doing all of his different characters. So he'd leave the stage, they'd play music and then play a video like of one of his things. And then he'd come back out and he'd come out for like 6 or 7 minutes in that the next character or whatever. And I do feel like if he had a little bit more experience with stand-up and wrote some actual jokes for the characters, I think that could take that up to the next level. But then again, what am I talking about? He's selling out everywhere he's going. Yeah. So.
I don't know how I feel about it. I've heard stand-ups being pissed about this.
Yeah.
Like, oh, these internet people are taking our... I don't know. I think all of it's like good for the industry. Like, any of this stuff, if it's promoting comedy and promoting whatever, right. Like, why, it's not a tick for tack, like, no pun intended, but like, you doing that isn't taking food off of somebody else's plate. Like,
right. Right.
I guess it's canceling the open mic that night, but
I mean, it is too bad that we didn't get to hear Justin Land tell some jokes that day.
Yeah.
But, and I love
he's your so much, favorite.
I know. Yeah, I love him. I agree. I do see where, especially like really seasoned comics would be like, no, this is our yard. So I do mm-hmm. understand that part of it also. And you can tell it's affected him too, because when he was talking to just me, he's like, you know, a lot of stand-ups hate me. And he goes, you know, what they don't understand is that I used to do stand up. And it's like, no, you did some open mics 20 years ago and then you got online. So like, mm-hmm. let's also not pretend that you have this long stand up career. You know what I mean? But yeah, I think it is just kind of the new world, because it's just something that's offered, that's out there, that people can capitalize on and do it. I think in a perfect world, if you're going to do stand-up, you should have gone through the open mics and gone through like building material and all that sort of stuff. But that's just, that's also a personal thing for me. A lot of people think of me as like a TikTok guy. Like, you didn't even know that I did stand-up before TikTok. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be the TikTok guy on stage. I want to be a comedian who is like getting his name through social media.
Has it been difficult though, like growing into that, where you're touring way before your peers are touring at the same like duration that you've been doing comedy? Like, has there been a big learning curve for you?
Yeah, but I do. I mean, again, part of me for a while was feeling almost guilty, kind of, because I was like, you know, pay my dues. I'm a big believer in that. But then I was like, also, it's all entertainment. It's all, and you add in the pro wrestling stuff. If you look at it that way, I've been on the road doing live entertainment for now over 20 years. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a totally different thing, of course, now, stand-up from wrestling. But it is, there's a lot of improv in both. There's a lot of, you know, reading the crowd and working with the audience and all that sort of stuff in both. So it's not like, I don't think that I could necessarily do what I have been doing if I hadn't had, like, that all the experience. Background. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I wish I had 18 years of fucking experience on in front of audiences before doing it. I think it's funny where people always put that, like, time card on shit. It's like, oh, you've been doing it X long. Like, we've all had different life experiences. So What you bring to that first open mic is, you see somebody who's like 18 or 20 go up and do that versus somebody that's 30. Like, what are they talking about? They've lived two-thirds of what that person's next to them has lived. And I'm not saying like the guy who's 60 at open mic is going to fucking crush, because we've seen the other side of that. But it's, you pull from all those experiences. Like, how long, you wrestled for almost 20 years. Are you still doing it?
No. I quit wrestling. I had one last match after I got the golden ticket on Kill Tony. But the day that I got that golden ticket and the day I did Kill Tony, that was the day that I decided, and I realized, like, I should have been doing stand-up. I should have followed the stand-up dream all along. Mm-hmm. Or maybe not, too. Like, maybe it just worked out better, because when I think back to who I was when I was 18, 19, I would not, I don't believe, have been able to put together or survived in stand-up. You know, because, like, I was scared to be on stage. I don't think that I could have handled bombing at all. Yeah. I don't think I could have, you know, stuck through it. So I think that wrestling really did toughen me up for that sort of stuff. I'm not wrestling anymore, because ultimately I wasn't happy the last several years that I was doing it. And I
just, what league were you wrestling in?
So at the time when I quit, I was the only promotion I was really working for was my best friend's company out of Oregon.
Okay.
And he was doing really well. He was doing monthly shows and selling out the building that he was in. It was a lot of fun working with him, but I also knew that there was no future for me.
Because we just had Vicky Dreamboat on.
Okay.
She's working her way up through like AEW right now.
Yeah.
And she did improv in Seattle, and that's how I know her. But she's been doing some backyard stuff, kind of gave us some inside stuff on wrestling and like what she called, like, don't be giving away the business, but like some... Like, I didn't know. I watched wrestling my whole life growing up, and I had no idea, like, throughout the whole match, you're talking with the other guy, and the ref's there playing it's a safety person.
Yeah, well, like, in a perfect world, that's the way it should be. There's a lot of people, and this is one of those things where I was more of an old soul with wrestling, because I liked the idea of, you would hear, like, a promoter would come up to you, or the booker would come up to you and say, look, you and Adam, you're going out, you're doing 30 minutes, you're going over, and that's it. And then we would just hit the ring and just call it and work with the crowd and all that sort of stuff. I love that. That was like romanticized in my head. Throughout most of the time that I wrestled, most of the people in the locker room wanted to sit there for a couple of hours before the show and like, okay, we'll lock up and then I'll put you in a headlock and then you'll do that. You'll give me an armbar and I'll reverse it. And it's like, that to me is just...
Did it ever even work doing it that way?
I mean, it does for a lot of people. But it, famously, I'm well past the idea that you can expose the wrestling business, because this is really famous. If you're a wrestling fan, you've already heard this, but there's a really famous match between Macho Man Randy Savage and Ricky Steamboat from WrestleMania 3. Mm-hmm. If you were a fan in the 1980s, that was your favorite match, period. And it's really famously known that Steamboat hated that match because Savage had like scripted it out and worked it out for like weeks. They would get a hotel room together and work it out beforehand, because Savage wanted, I think a lot of it was Savage just really wanted to steal the show from Hogan and Andre, which they were going to do anyway, because they're just better.
I love all the name dropping, by the way, because I know most of who you're talking about, but it's just, it's, I grew up watching wrestling from like 98 to,
or
97 to like 2002 or so.
Okay. Once, so you grew up in those 5 years.
Yeah, well, in those 5 years, yeah. I watched it. I knew, like, if you said who's Hulk Hogan when I was a kid, I would know.
Sure.
But Undertaker, Mankind, like that Hell in a Cell match.
Yeah.
I went to SummerSlam. I went to the SummerSlam when Jesse Ventura came back.
Oh, nice.
He was the governor.
But in Minnesota, right? Yeah. That was the Triple H Mick Foley Rock match, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
God, The Rock was just, I mean, out of control. When you look at guys like that, like, what makes them so good? Is it the like acting and all that shit, or is it?
It's weird. I think Roddy Piper. Have you heard of Roddy Piper?
I have. I'm not super familiar with him.
It's so weird. Like talking to people. This is one of the weird things. Starting comedy when I did, which was only a few years ago, and then seeing you, like, I would consider us to be peers, and you're so young. It's so gross.
How old are you though?
I'm 43.
Okay, so yeah. That makes sense. There's about like a 10-year gap from what? Because my buddy, he's about your age, and we talked about wrestling all the time at work, and he would throw out these names and be like, oh, I miss that guy. Like, if you check out on wrestling for like 15 minutes, you have no idea what the fuck's going on.
That's true. It's fun because I started watching wrestling in 1986. I stopped watching wrestling in 2019.
So you kept, I don't watch, watching.
The only thing that I watch,
that was like a 40-year period of time.
Well, and here's the thing. This is going to sound so stupid, but from probably about 2002 on, I really didn't like wrestling. Mm-hmm. But I did feel like, because I was in the industry, I felt like it was important for me to keep up with what was going on.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like I sat there and watched Monday Night Raw every week, but I watched enough of it to know what was going on at all times. Because I just thought that, what if I just tore down the whole studio right now?
And speaking of which,
I pull out a steel chair and slam me in the head. But yeah, I just felt like, even though, like, I wanted to do something original, I wanted to do something different than what people were watching on TV. But if I wasn't seeing the same thing they were watching on TV, then I wouldn't know what they were watching. To be different, if that makes sense. That was at least what was going on in my head.
So what were you trying to do? Because you were the American wet dream.
The American wet dream, baby.
And what was your, did you have a catchphrase?
I didn't really have a catchphrase, because again, that's something that's a little bit newer. I like the idea of going out and doing promos in a way that I was trying to be realistic. Like, I'm obviously don't consider myself to be a sexy guy, but I used to always want to be that guy. So I tapped into that part of myself, that part of my psyche, to be the American wet dream.
I mean, dude, I watched some of your videos. You weren't bad. Like, you had flow. You had a baby face. Like, I could see it.
There was a time where that's what I wanted to be called, baby face. And I wanted to, my plan was I was just going to do death matches and get so by the time I was my age now, I'd just be sliced up all over the face. And then I realized that baby face was an inside term that too many people knew. So it wouldn't have worked.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did a lot more of playing with the crowd than worrying about doing really big moves, which I couldn't do anyway. Like, I don't know if it's that obvious, but I'm not the most athletic person on the planet. So my thing was always the psychology of telling the story and working with the audience.
Yeah.
You know,
comedy has a weird level of similarity to that too.
I think so.
Where, like, at least in clubs, I think everything's so constricted, so it's just like, it's sort of like the match where you're like, you're doing the act. When there's 200 people in the room, like, you don't have a lot in terms of the showmanship. Like, it's like the everything kind of compresses. But when you're in smaller rooms and like 30, 40 people, you have to like ham it up a little bit and get them to buy in.
Two nights ago, I had a comedy show that reminded me so much of my wrestling career because it was a show in Ording at a bar there. It was Brandon Valentine's room there. Mm-hmm. And he had me closing and Burundi was featuring. So Burundi just murdered, just slayed, just destroyed. He's hilarious. And I was watching the whole time going, what the fuck am I going to do to follow this? You know what I mean? Like, I'm confident in my material, mm-hmm. but at the same time, I'm not saying, like, I don't want people leaving going, like, that middle guy should have been on last. So I started thinking in terms of, like, what I used to do in wrestling. Wrestling, I'd watch the matches in the back and be like, okay, these are what these guys are doing, so I got to try to change it up. So when I got on stage two nights ago, I took the mic. It was a wireless mic, and I just went into the audience. And I just, like, Don Rickled my way through the entire audience, just table by table, roasting everybody back and forth. And I did like 25 minutes of just riffing with every individual table.
Yeah.
And then people were like, you know, they definitely saw the better comedian first, for sure. But they enjoyed the interaction of my set so much that it was like, oh, okay, I see why he was the last guy, if that makes sense. You know,
it's so weird, though, when you say, oh, see that better comedian first. I don't really... We're all like in this thing together.
Right. Oh, yeah.
So you get this opportunity to close the show based off of a variety of things.
Right.
And like you're getting to learn how to do this completely different thing because you're in that situation. Like you're going to lean on that at some point in the future, too. So how you grow, I don't like there's this idea of like, oh, you need to do open mics and you need to do these like booked local shows and then you host and then you feature like. You don't get to pick when your opportunities come. Like what you need to do is be able to be ready when somebody says, hey, can you do this?
Right. And that's true. I think that I still have that, like I said, that kind of that guilt in the back of my mind where I'm like, I shouldn't be. But at the same time, it's something that Casey McClain was the first one that was like, he's like, dude, you don't know how long the TikTok thing is going to last. He's like, this could be all, he's like, you got to do whatever you possibly can now. For while sure. you have the opportunity. And if you get, he's like, you're going to be cutting some lines. He's like, and you got to own that. You just got to do it. And then like, I turn that into at my age and BMI, I'm not going to be on this planet for a super long time. So I got to at least make it happen when I do. But I still have that. Like, I don't know if it's overly, like, I hate people that are like overly humble and they try to be, you know, and I'm not trying to be like that, but when I'm watching Burundi just murder, I'm like, oh, should I be the guy closing? That's where my mind automatically
goes. Of course. But I think, you know, in that, we're all fucking sensitive people. Like, people don't get that about comics. Like, when you see somebody go up there and like, oh, look at them or whatever. Like, Burundi is a sensitive person, just like you are a sensitive person. And I am a sensitive... Like, there's a reason why we like to make people laugh.
Right.
And, you know, it... All these other factors, like, do I deserve this or whatever? Like, I mean, it's got to, like, be frustrating for you at times where, like, you're pursuing these things. And you're doing the things that you know that you need to do, but you're getting that shit, right? Like, or feel like you're getting that shit. There's, like, a lot of jealousy and envy and like, but the reality is you made that fucking TikTok.
Right.
Nobody else did. Like, I don't really get it. It's like, oh, this guy's doing this. Nobody else made the video,
right?
And pursued it. So I think it's an interesting thing, like comics cutting other comics down and trying to, like, you know, give it's all rationalizing why they don't have what you have.
Right. Yeah. No, it's so weird. It's the way, like you said, we're all sensitive people. If you were talking to somebody else sitting right here, I'd be like, he's 100% right. But you're talking to me and I'm like, yeah, but I mean, that's still like, I'm a piece of shit though. You don't understand.
You didn't do anything wrong.
Right.
I mean, if you cut the line in a way that was like shitty, then I guess maybe I would take issue with it. But like what Joe Dombrowski came on, he told a very similar story where he's like, yeah, I was doing comedy for 11 years and I had this thing pop off and there was this huge opportunity and I pursued it. I'm like, to me, I don't take issue with that.
Yeah.
Like, And also, a lot of this stuff, like you said, getting people in on off nights at comedy clubs, selling tickets to people that wouldn't normally be there, it promotes comedy. So I don't really, like, if you're taking weekends from incredible headliners, that's going to take away the quality of the comedy. But dude, there's 365 days out of the year, and a lot of these comedy clubs, like, they're struggling to get people in seats every night.
Right.
No, it's a really hard thing to do.
Yeah.
Without spending 20, 30 grand to get the best comics in the US to come out.
Right.
And the whole thing is changing too, where, you know, TV credits are, you know, not what they used to be. And late night, Kermit was saying recently, like, when guys would do late night, they'd do Carson or whatever, like, they were guaranteed a career in comedy.
Isn't that crazy?
One thing.
Right.
Now it's like, there's no one specific thing that makes you.
Right.
Which is...
it's wild, too, because it's so weird, because we don't have that, but what we do have now is we do have the internet. We have everything that's available on the internet, and I've heard, like, comedians like Joe List talk about it, how there's all these other things that you have to do, like podcasts and videos and YouTube and all this sort of stuff. There's all these things that you kind of have to do as a part of comedy to get yourself out there, which is kind of a pain in the ass to have to do all that stuff when all you want to do is, you know, go out at 8 o'clock at night and tell jokes. But that's what gets you in that position to be able to make a good living doing it.
What the hell were the people like 20 years ago doing during the day and shit?
Yeah, I know.
Just cocaine?
It's got to be. I think that's what it was. It had to be.
It just seemed like such a... I mean, Kermit was saying those comedy clubs in the 80s, you would get, I think, I want to say he said like 2 to 3 grand a weekend. And there were guys working 40 weekends out of the year. Man. And like, that's probably half of what they're... or like twice as much of what they're paying for a lot of comics now.
Yeah, yeah.
It's crazy. And that was in 1980. Can you... the value of that is probably $5,000-$6,000.
Oh, easy. Yeah, and there was very few... I don't think that everybody was a Jerry Seinfeld or a George Carlin that would just sit there in an office. Like, you heard Carlin had an office that he'd go to and write for 8 hours a day.
Did he do that?
That's the story that I heard recently, that he would sit there and he would do 8 hours of writing. Like halfway through the day, he'd smoke some weed and then he'd punch up what he'd written the first 4 hours.
Really? Carlin?
Not Seinfeld. But Seinfeld has always talked about how he saw people in the corporate world that, you know, they had to put in their 40 weeks or 40 hours a week. And he's like, I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to put in 40 hours a week writing.
Yeah.
Now you still have to put in a ton of time writing, obviously. But you also have to do these internet things, but it opens it up more. Now we don't have to worry about, like, okay, I got to get on Carson. You know, because first off, it would be hard to do that since he's dead for 20 years now. But also, now you can just go out and create your own stuff on the internet, and then you got to hope that the algorithm picks it up and people start watching it and stuff like that. It's all still fucked and difficult, but I think it has opened the doors more, that you do have more control over what you're doing. You don't have to wait for a TV show or whatever.
Do you think your stuff has gotten better as you've done more of it?
My stand-up?
Your TikTok stuff.
Oh, I kind of think so, because now, like, I don't want... I think, again, going back to Casey McClain, like, when I did similar What's That things about Black people, white people, gay people, transgender people, Mexicans. And then eventually, like, I remember once Casey wrote me, he's like, pretty soon you're going to run out of people to talk about. So now I have to create different ways to still do What's That, because that's what people... Now, the cool thing is there's 1,000 different things that you can do, and they're all jokes, and they're all, you know, real to me. It's not like I'm just going out there and coming up with necessarily hacky things that I just wanted to say just so I can get a What's That in there. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that people really do legitimately seem to like it. I mean, which is weird to me that, you know, but that's, you know, it also makes sense though, because it's not something that I sat down and I constructed. I feel like a lot of times people try to, like, okay, I'm going to do this joke and I'm going to use this catchphrase and then I'm going to sell merch with that. And then it doesn't work out, whereas this was just totally random.
But you were doing it through this piece of technology.
Right.
That's The reason why I ask is this podcast, I started it, dude. I don't think I could listen to the early episodes. Yeah. Like, I really don't think so. And I still, like, I know that I'm getting better at podcasting, but you're doing it here right now. It's not easy. Like, it's just a weird thing, you know? Like, we're having this authentic conversation, but these microphones, like, we're just supposed to ignore these cameras and shit. And it's weird to me. But as I've gotten doing it, like, I've tried, oh, how do you prep for this? How do you, you know, be more structured? I don't really have the formula. All I know is that the more I do it, the more natural it feels.
Right.
It's like stand-up.
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, you got to put in that 40 hours a week, whatever that looks like. And
yeah.
I think the same applies to, like, just TikTok or whatever it is that you're doing. You have to, like, you got to do a lot of it to the point where it's just, I mean, you caught it where you're like, I don't even give a shit. Like, just shoot. Like, right. And that ends up being a really natural thing. But then when you try to recreate that,
then it's, yeah.
It's like the guy that's drunk at open mic, goes up for the first time, and he crushes. And then he's like, I'm coming back every week. And then, like, he's sober the next week, and he eats shit.
He spends the whole week going, like, I'm going to clean up my act. I'm gonna write.
Do everything different than what I did last time.
Right, right.
Without realizing it.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know what? You talk about podcasts, and this is a difficult thing to do. And obviously, like I can tell, not just from the equipment that you have, but also the way that you're hosting this, the way that we're talking and everything like that, you obviously have the experience. You're getting better and better. Podcasts are not a natural thing. It is very weird. I remember I tried to start a podcast about wrestling years ago, mm-hmm. and I had one of my closest friends on because I thought, okay, this will be the easiest thing to do. We can have a nice, normal conversation like we have for years on the road. And I think one of my first questions, because he had just had a kid, I was like, I tried to do a segue, and I'm like, so we talked about his new baby, and then I was like, so now when you got started in wrestling, you weren't a lot older than your newborn because you were 18. And he's just like, what? It was so hard to, like you said, have a natural conversation where I keep looking over and trying to check if my hair is looking good.
Exactly. It's just I don't know how to do it. I really don't. I fucking hope that eventually it'll click for me, but I'm just trying to get better at it. And I forget to mention you mentioned Casey several times. He has a podcast, right?
He does, yeah.
What's it called again?
It's called Nobody Likes Casey McClain, or Everybody Hates Casey McClain. I think it's Nobody Likes
okay.
Casey McClain.
Check that out if you're watching us on YouTube. Download Casey's stuff. He's a funny comic. Works mainly in Tacoma, right?
Yeah, well, Tacoma's definitely his home club, yeah. But he's getting out there quite a bit, too.
Nice. Can we talk about Kill Tony?
Sure.
Before we get into the story segment?
Sure.
How long had you been doing stand-up before that?
A little bit less than a year.
Okay. So you were new.
Yeah, I was really new.
I think they did Portland for that run and then came up to Seattle.
Yeah, they did Portland. They did one show in Portland and then one show in Vancouver, BC. And then on the Sunday, they did two shows in Seattle.
I was there for that.
Were you?
Yeah. And my buddy, Dustin, who has been on Kill Tony, like, got his name pulled. He was down in Portland. Like, he went down there and he wanted the first time for him doing stand up to be on Kill Tony. And I was like, hey man, I don't think that's a great idea.
Right.
I don't think you should do that. And then I think he had an extra ticket or something, or I got a ticket to Kill Tony at Chop Suey in Seattle.
Yep.
So it was around the same time. But you got the golden ticket.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
So I was, I went there for the show and just randomly got drawn, which, okay, here's the thing. I have never really fully believed in being able to manifest things mentally, mm-hmm. but for at least a month before, once I got the tickets, for about a month, I daydreamed, pictured, whatever, thought about my set. I thought about getting pulled up. I thought about my set. And then I thought about talking about wrestling. I thought about Jeremiah Watkins, who I pictured in his feminist character, which was, if for those that don't watch Kill Tony, back when they had that band. Jeremiah Watkins and Joel Jimenez would come out dressed as, you know, like in pink wigs and purple wigs, and they would just be the ultimate, like, you know, fuck men type feminists. And so we would, so I pictured that. I pictured him and I wrestling on stage and all this sort of stuff. And literally everything came to fruition exactly how I pictured it. Even like they would do different characters every week for the show. And when the show first started and they introduced the band and they came out as the feminist, I remember thinking, holy shit, this is going to happen. And I remember even like picturing getting a golden ticket, which was wild because then I got pulled up, I got called up, and I remember walking around backstage and then coming out on the theater, coming out on the stage and then doing my 60-second set. And at the end of that, what one of the things that I think really sealed it for me was that at least half the audience stood up and cheered at the end.
It was incredible.
It was fucking
wild. I watched the video. If you haven't seen it and you're on YouTube, make sure to check it out after this podcast. But it is incredible. I mean, I've been to the live shows before. I've seen it go well. I've seen it go poorly. A bunch of people who've been on, Dustin Diekel was the guy that I was talking about. Hans Kim has been on, and he's kind of made a career from Kill Tony.
He's killing it off of that. He's
unbelievable.
On the road in private jets, opening for Rogan.
He went from this podcast to opening Joe Rogan. I mean, it's insane. And did you end up, you went back on, right?
Yeah, I've been on a few times because I did do Chop Suey. I went up, I did the second show for Chop Suey in Seattle, and then I flew down to LA and did the Comedy Store because it was one of those things like, yeah, you're doing the 60-second set or whatever, but I had to, you know, have no idea where your comedy career is going to go, but like I've been obsessed with the Comedy Store for decades. Like, I've always loved that place. So just being there was cool enough. But
what was it like to be on stage there?
My God, it was amazing. Yeah. The club itself is so cool. Miss Pat was the guest, so she's sitting right there, which is fun. You got Tony and the whole band is there. And just like the size of the main room, I didn't realize really how big it was until
it's huge.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's, how many does it see? Like 600?
600, yeah.
It's so big. I mean, that's a massive space,
yeah,
for just a club.
And then just like Ali Makovsky was the person who took me to my seat, which was, again, it's weird because Ali I was a fan of from Kill Tony. She had been a regular before. She was the Hans Kim of the mid-2000s or the late-2000s or whatever. But you know, she's working the door, and you'd always heard about, you know, Kinison worked the door there and all this sort of stuff. So you see these comedians now working the door. David Lucas was working the door too, and it was crazy being in that building, knowing the history of it.
It's so wild that you had this like crazy good experience because Dustin came on and he had just such a rough one. Like,
really?
The guy that wanted to go up for the first time. Because we were at Chop Suey together and he hadn't gone up yet.
Was that the show that, so you guys were there for the first one?
First
so
one, yeah.
That was the one Levi was on, right?
Yep, yep. Okay. So he went up, Levi went up. But I was sitting in the audience. My name was in the bucket. I had been doing stand-up about the same time as you had. And I didn't visualize. I knew what I was going to do, but it would just be like recital, you know?
Yeah.
And they would have lit me up in the... I mean, you did a really good job with your panel.
The panel went well. The first set of jokes went well because I hit like the biggest ones that I had. Like I had the best jokes that I had that I'd worked on for a year. The second time when I had to go up, I remember my wife and I were like writing jokes on the way up to Seattle. And I was like, at one point I almost just decided, I was like, I'm just going to tell this story about this weird thing that happened when I was a kid, you know, just to keep it real. But then I was like, nah, that doesn't seem right. I think the thing that cinched it for the second time in Seattle, I made a joke about Amy Schumer. Mm-hmm. And so that, like, right away, Tony was in love with me at that point. But
it's doing a minute is such a weird thing.
So weird.
I don't know of any real other show that you do a minute of stand-up comedy and then just get eviscerated by a panel full of people.
And it's so funny how the show has like really evolved too, because if you look at the really old ones back in the belly room, it was a lot more of just, it was like it was almost like a college course in stand-up, because it was more just breaking down what you know your comedy. It was originally called Hinchcliffe Notes. And it was just going to be like notes on your jokes and your presentation, all that sort of stuff. And then it just evolved into roasting, which of course makes sense because that's going to get you a broader audience, and that's when they started being able to tour and stuff like that with the show.
But. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dustin, he did his first set on Kill Tony at Skankfest.
Holy shit.
And he told the story on here, and I mean, I fucking love this dude. But the balls to even do that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it just, it's like, he's the most hardcore Legion of Skanks fan and all this shit. And like, he went, when I opened for Big J, I got him to come down and shit. But like, I, even now, like if somebody said, go do a minute in front of that audience, fuck, man.
It's so, I think... It's weird because I remember the very first open mic I did, and you do 3 minutes, mm-hmm. right? And a friend of mine who had been doing comedy for about 10 years at that point was like, that's the longest 3 minutes of your life, which is true. And then for a while, it's always like 3 minutes, 4 minutes. This is like the perfect time. Then, but once you get to that point where you can do 20 minutes on stage, 25 minutes or whatever, and you have the freedom to kind of play around and like let the jokes breathe and stuff like that, then the idea of shortening it to like 4 minutes, 3 minutes or whatever, like it's so difficult to go back to like the open mics at the comedy club because you only get 4 minutes. And then like now I know, if not before, I'm going to do another Kill Tony in October. So to do 1 minute, I'm sitting there, I'm trying to think like, what do I have that I can do?
It's such a weird puzzle to solve.
Yeah. Yeah.
I haven't done it. I'm not jealous of anybody that has to, because that's, I guess like what you said, just do your best shit.
Yeah.
Like, but it's gotta be short and poppy and like,
but I will say, I think that taught me a lot because, like I said, the first one I had a few jokes, and then the second time that I went up, I was trying to come up with some stuff, and it made me realize it changed the way that I wrote things. Cause then instead of trying to go for, you know, long drawn out, not drawn out, but longer story, I realized I need to put a punchline everywhere, like every other line or whatever. So then that way I can break things apart and okay, those would be my jokes that I tell on Kill Tony. They might be part of a 5 minute bit, but I can just pull out a couple of one liners from that bit.
Comedy sucks, dude. it's so like you start thinking you have something figured out and then like, then you start seeing it differently and you start seeing it differently. And I don't know. It's even you talking about like longer stories like that. It like gave me anxiety just hearing it. So I'm like, God, I have stuff like that that I want to do,
yeah.
But I'm like, I just don't, I'm not there with it yet. And it's not for me, like when a joke comes to me, then I can build off of it.
Right.
But like, if I don't have that happen, and I'm like, oh, I want to make this story into, I just every time I'm like, I just end up wanting to throw something against the wall. Like oh, I can't get it.
100%. Right now I'm working on this thing about ghosts. And I realized like I was able to, like I had a couple of jokes that I thought were funny. They've worked well. And now I've been able to add other stuff like fear of dying, thoughts about dying, suicide, whatever. Like, and I can build like this, it's BMI. Pretty dark, but it's like, yeah. it builds from that because it started with just two jokes that I kind of had. On the other hand, I have a story that I'm like the drunk guy that you talked about. I told it once, totally just as a story that I would tell my friends, and it killed. And then now I've tried to like joke it up for stand up, and I've never been able to do well with it. And I know that it's a good story, but like I gotta, like it's something
it's
that
you. So annoying.
It's very annoying. It's
like there's, I've always said like, writing jokes is like turning off all the lights in your kitchen and like trying to make a cake. Like you can't see anything and you just start grabbing ingredients.
Right, yeah.
And then the only time that you can actually taste it is like when the lights come on and somebody has a spoon in your mouth already. And like you don't, the joke's already out, like you're tasting it already.
Yeah.
And then it's up to you to go back and like revise, but like you got these fucking terrible, like you just don't know until you bring it in front of people.
That's it. That's the perfect, it's like people have talked a lot about how, you know, comedy and music, it's totally different because music, you write everything out. If you're in a band, you get your song written, you rehearse it, you do like, you get it perfect studio quality before anybody hears it. And stand up, the only way you can do it is just go out there and start telling
people.
There's
no fucking garage to practice it. There are people that do it that way, and you can see it's creepy as shit.
Right.
It is not, it's not good.
And you can tell the difference too, because then they go up on stage in front of real people. And it, the jokes don't go the way that they think they will because their buddies aren't laughing at it. You know?
It's weird.
Yeah.
All right. You ready for this story time?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Got to cue the music for it.
It's story time. It's story time with Fathom, yeah, it's story time. It's story time with Fathom and Friends.
I love that.
It's gentle, but it's nice.
Does a video play when you play that music?
I don't know. I have to check.
Or is it just a shot of us? Because I realized I started dancing.
I never know what to do. I think dance, it would be weird if I got too into my own music.
I think that would be awesome. If all of a sudden you just stood up and you start lip syncing it. Start like trying to get a wave going on the couch.
The funny thing is Jamal and Chase Murphy were here. And as soon as it started, they just like immediately, and I'm just sitting like the video of it's hilarious. I'll show it to you.
Perfect.
Anyway, story time.
So I want to tell this story because it's the first, this is how I got into professional wrestling. And, okay, no preface, but so when I was 18 years old, I did want to do stand-up and I tried to do stand-up and I called the, Comedy Underground and I asked, I think they might've been the Improv at that time, but I don't remember for sure. But anyway, the point is, I called there and I asked them how to get up and I don't know if they didn't have open mics at the time, but the guy told me I needed to send them a tape before I could go on stage there. So I called this restaurant locally in Oak Harbor where I was living, and I knew that they had live music every Tuesday. And I said I was a comedian, I was in town, and I wanted to go up on stage and do 15 minutes if that was possible. And they said, yeah, absolutely, we can definitely do that. And so we booked this, we booked 15 minutes, and I remember on my way, this is where I was at mentally. On my way to the restaurant, I was thinking to myself, what am I going to talk about? Because I honestly believed at the time that stand-ups just went up on stage and just, like a lot of people think this, they just come up with stuff, just make things up.
I mean, just side note, 15 minutes is so much time. like when you're starting, like you're like, oh, I'd love to be, I mean, when you start bombing, 15 minutes feels like 5 hours.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Sorry.
No. That's what I'm saying. That's why earlier when I said I would never have survived as a stand-up if I'd started then. Luckily, I went to the restaurant. They had like a little reader board up front. It was like such and such band or whatever it was called. And then it was like, plus comedy, Todd Royce. And I was like, wow, this is like, I was like, okay, well, this is really, really cool. And
that
then
was
I,
easy.
Yeah, I made it. And then I looked into the room and there was a band on the floor. There was no stage. Cause in my mind, of course, I was picturing like a club with all this. It's a restaurant. There's like, they moved some tables and set up the band there with a microphone. And there were two tables of people. And I looked at it. I was expecting 400 people all in suits. I don't know. I was expecting that this was like the Copacabana or whatever. And, as soon as I saw that, I turned around and walked out. And I was like, that's it. I'm never doing stand-up. I can't do that. So that was the end of my stand-up. So
there was no Todd Royce that night.
There was no Todd Royce. I don't know what they did. Those people went home heartbroken.
I'm sure they managed. But
and so then I was like, well, I don't know what I'm going to do. Like, I was going to do stand-up. And you know, I've always wanted to do pro wrestling, blah, blah, blah. Found out about 2 years later that this wrestling promotion called ECCW, I don't know if you've ever heard of the promotion ECW out of Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they were Extreme Championship Wrestling.
That was like Sting and...
Oh, you young, it's silly bastard.
Sting was...
WCW.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. ECW is more like nails and like...
nails?
I thought like a bed of nails and
oh shit. Yeah.
It was more extreme.
There was a wrestler in the early 90s in WWF called Nails, and I was did you think Nails was an easy? I don't know. Okay, let's start from the beginning with wrestling. In 1905, George Hackenschmidt. There was a promotion in Philadelphia called ECW Extreme Championship Wrestling. There were some people in British Columbia that started a promotion called Extremely Canadian Championship Wrestling. It was originally started out as like a joke version of ECW, but then they started to catch on as wrestling got bigger in the late 90s, and they became Extreme Canadian Championship Wrestling. Anyway, they started coming down to Washington. They did a show in Mount Vernon, and I went to that show. And I saw, I was sitting front row, and I looked over off to the side. I saw someone standing behind the curtain. This wrestler named Gorgeous Michelle Starr, who I had watched when I was a kid back in the 80s wrestle for the local Vancouver promotion on TV. And I freaked out because I've never been around any form of celebrity at this point in my life. And I was like, my God, it's Michelle Starr. I'm 19 years old or whatever, or 20 years old at this time. Michelle Starr, it's Michelle Starr.
What were you wearing?
I know what I was wearing because I was wearing this gray t-shirt that came to about here on my body, and then jeans that covered my fupa and then went down my and the glasses, not like these, they were much smaller glasses, but they were broken, like they didn't have the nose part here, so they were kind of like off to the side, like
just
this.
Super fan,
just like, oh my God, a super geek fan. I remember one of the wrestlers' names on the show was Chi-Chuck, and I brought a little sign that said Chi-Chuck-a-mania. I had no idea who the guy was, but I was like, I want to have a sign.
You got to support someone.
Yeah, and then years later, I met and worked with Chi-Chuck, and he was a piece of shit, and I hated his guts. But I think Starr saw me react like that. And so during his match, he was at the main event tag team match. During his match, he came out of the ring, came over to me, and I remember being like, I was so starstruck for this guy, and I hate saying it because I know him so well now, but I was so starstruck at Michelle Starr standing over me, and he grabbed me by my shirt and started like, shut up, blah, blah, whatever, right? And at the time, I had been watching wrestling shoot interviews. I was a big fan of like the inner workings of pro wrestling, so I was like, I know he's not going to do anything to me, but I also don't want to be one of these dicks that just like I'm standing up against him because I know he can't do anything. So I start cowering in fear, which I'm sure like at this point with no acting experience, nothing like that, I'm sure I look just like, ah! Like I'm just like, just very cartoony. And he's like pointing at me and like cocking his fist and then gets back in the ring and finishes. After the show's over, he comes walking out and he walks up to me before I can leave. And he's like, hey, I just wanted to say to you real quick that I'm sorry about all that. And he's like, I was just, you know, it's just part of the show. And I was like, I totally understand. No worries at all. I was working. I'm sure I was like being really annoying. Like how hecklers are like, I was just trying to make the show a little bit more fun. I was like, hey, I was trying to work with you. And he goes, and so then I was like, I heard that you have a wrestling school. And he's like, yeah. And I said, I'd like to like maybe come out and try out for it. Kind of expecting, because like at the time, by the way, I was way bigger than I am now. I was well over 5 bills.
Really?
Oh, God, yeah. And so I was totally expecting what he should have done, which was you should hit the gym a little bit because you're already sweating and all you did was stand up kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But he handed me all the paperwork and he's like, here's how much it costs, blah, blah, blah. So I went there. I went to the training center. Got in, started wrestling. We were training in a boxing gym or a boxing ring, which was a lot stiffer than a wrestling ring. Got into wrestling, finally got on the road, all that sort of stuff. Later, Starr told me the true story of what had happened. Washington State is heavily watched over by the Washington State Athletic Commission for pro wrestling for some reason. I don't know why. There's an athletic commission. I had to get a physical every year before I could wrestle in Washington State. Starr, after he grabbed me by the shirt, he walked to the back. Now, keep in mind, at this time, like I said, I'm 500 pounds. I have really long hair. I had glasses. I had no facial hair at all because I couldn't grow a beard to save my life. Apparently, he went back there, and the commissioner came up to him and said, I don't want the state sued. I don't want you to get sued. So you need to go out there when this show's over and apologize to that fat woman on the front row. And the look of glee in Starr's eyes as he told me that and has told me it over and over again. Every time we're around somebody, he's like, hey, tell him about the time. You know,
I just fell out.
Go apologize to that fat. So he came out there, and when he got in my face, and then I started talking about wrestling, I think he was about to be like, you know, like, yeah, we have women wrestlers too, which would have just like destroyed me at the time. You know, now
I could
just
be a girl.
I mean, he's Michelle Starr. He would wear lipstick and like a star on his eye and all that sort of stuff. So, but yeah, that's how I got involved in pro wrestling. Is I was misgendered by the Washington State Athletic Commission.
That is amazing. God damn. Thank you for sharing that. That's awesome. Well, before we go,
did we get another song?
No other song, but I was wondering, do you want to, any chance you want to do a promo for this episode and we can maybe cut it up?
Sure.
Like wrestling style promo.
Oh, like a wrestling style
promo? Yeah. Just into that camera.
Yeah, I can do that.
Maybe use your catchphrase if you want to. I don't know.
Okay.
I know it's on the spot, but.
Sure.
It's the way you like it.
No worries at all. Okay. Yeah, let's do it. Here we go. The name of the show, Fatim and Friends, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's on YouTube or just wherever you get podcasts and YouTube.
Okay. So I would go. Listen up, everybody. This is Top Choice, Todd Royce, the American wet dream. And I am here as a part of Fatim and Friends, the number one podcast in all of podcast history. And what's that? That's Rogan. Okay. Well, let's pretend for a second. So big, bad Adam and Todd Royce, and we're going to be doing, what's that? I fucked it up already. I did. I haven't done a promo in a long time. It's weird. Okay. Don't call me that. Make sure and get this wherever you get your podcast, where you listen to it, where you watch it, YouTube, and don't forget to follow me on YouTube as well.
Perfect, man.
That's perfect.
Speaking of which, where can people, besides TikTok, like where can our listeners, watchers follow your stuff? You're on YouTube.
Todd Royce XXL. Instagram, Todd Royce XXL. TikTok, Todd Royce XXL. And Twitter, Todd Royce XXL.
And then your website, is that?
ToddRoyceXXL.com.
Easy. Five simple plugs. There you go.
That's exactly. It's my goal weight to eventually be down to a double XL.
Bro, thank you for coming on. Really appreciate it. This was a lot of fun. Just a reminder, everybody, thanks again for listening and watching. If you are watching us on YouTube, hit that subscribe button, that like button, throw some comments and questions in for Todd or myself. And if you just listen to us, rate and review us wherever you get podcasts. And as always, follow us on Instagram at FNFpod. We're going to leave you with Jaga.
I just make the waves, I don't write them. I can hear the lyrics in my spirit as I write them. Why you wanna walk and talk just like them? I can't get caught up in all the hype and the excitement. I just make the waves, I don't write them. I can hear the lyrics in my spirit as I write them. Why you wanna walk and talk just like them? I can't get caught up in all the hype and the excitement. Welcome to my wave pool, 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 my wave pool.